Good morning. So last time we talked about out of order execution. We mentioned, okay, we have these new hazards if our processors are executing instructions out of order. For example, we might write the value for a register that's an old value after we write the value that's a newer value because we ran the instruction that computed the older value sometime after the one that computed the newer one. We need to deal with that somehow. And we have this sort of general strategy we mentioned, which was having different architectural registers, that is registers in assembly, versus the actual physical registers in our register file. And generally, we'd have a lot more physical registers. We use this strategy called register renaming, where we have this extra preprocessing step for instructions where we converted from the assembly's registers to these real physical registers. And we do this in a way where now we had a new physical register for each version of an architectural register. And after we do this, we don't have to worry anymore about, do I have the wrong version of some register like R9? Instead, with our physical registers, either we don't have the value yet, or we have the right value because there's only one version of each physical register. We also, in this transformation, made sure we had separate names for inputs and outputs. And this happened to give us a time where we could do other instruction translations. So for example, if we decided I didn't want to actually implement, you know, the push instruction with a special ALU, I could convert it in this step to two separate instructions. Now, once we did this instruction conversion, we had to dispatch instructions. And after doing register renaming, we had this nice scheme where we could look at each instruction that had been renamed. We could check its inputs. And for each input, we could just say, is this available yet? And that would tell us whether we could run it. And we try to match this up to the slots we have to run instructions. And generally, we have sort of these different types of slots. So for example, if we have like two ALUs in a data cache, well, you know, if I have an instruction that needs to add two values, I'm not going to send it to the data cache. So I need to be aware of those restrictions when I'm figuring out what instructions to actually dispatch. But we generally would look at our list of instructions, we'd run those that are ready, assigning them to the slots we have that can actually do the work for those instructions. Now, this was sort of the hardware implementation. We need to think about, well, how does this affect us as programmers? And one way of sort of reasoning about what the hardware's doing was this idea of data flow diagrams. That we'd say, okay, you know, what the hardware is doing is it's kind of running instructions once their values are ready. So I want to make sort of a diagram where I say, okay, if I have an operation, I'm going to represent its inputs as arrows going to a oval, in this case, representing the operation, and I'm going to represent how it's used as arrows coming from it. And this kind of is a graph in the sort of theory sense that tells us sort of how our instructions are going to be executed. And we can look at this and say, what does our processor have to do sort of sequentially and get the sort of limitations of, you know, what it can do quickly versus what it can't. And the big thing we wanted to look for is what things can the processor do in parallel. So one lesson we learned from looking at diagrams like this is that, you know, if I do say A plus B plus C plus D, that sort of operation, that's not going to give the processor much opportunity to run two things in parallel because we have to do A plus B before we can do the plus C part. If I reorganize that operation, for example, if I say do A plus B and add that, the quantity, to C plus D, which you compute separately, then the processor now can do A plus B and C plus D at the same time. We call this reassociation. And generally, as programmers, we have these options to transform our code in this sort of way to expose more things the processor can do in parallel, and that's going to make our code run faster. Because it's often the case that when we don't do something like this, the processor will have a whole bunch of instructions it's converted and got register renaming on, and it's going to look through that list and find, well, none of these are ready to run yet. And we also said, okay, we can do this transformation. We had a special version of this transformation that applied to loops. So often in a loop, we have the loop doing some like sum or product or similar accumulating operation, you know, for each iteration of the loop. And generally this means that, well, the way the loop's written, we have to compute the previous iteration and compute the next one. But we can transform the loop code so that's not the case anymore. And what we'll end up doing is sort of some iterations will add to one accumulator, for some will add to another, and we'll combine them at the end. And this will expose more parallel operations that can be done. So, and the reason why this is going to work is that it's going to turn out that even though we have separate loop iterations, that they're going to be running in parallel on our processor. Because our processor can do parts of two different loop iterations at the same time. Typically with multiple accumulators, we're also doing loop unrolling, so maybe it's more obvious they can run in parallel, but even when we don't do loop unrolling, because of branch prediction, the processor actually loads instructions from multiple iterations of the loop altogether. So questions about these things we covered last time? Okay, so I'm going to talk a little about the quiz. So quiz question one, all answers were accepted because I messed up in writing the question. I meant version A and B to be cache blocked versions, but I decided to make the loops over I and J start at 0 instead of II and JJ. I didn't notice it, and GAs who were proofreading it didn't notice it, so that question didn't make much sense. Also, I missed an A, I plus 1 in version B. But with that correction, let's talk about what the intention of the quiz was. So the first question, this kind of looks like cache blocking, but we haven't actually finished yet. So if I think of these first two loops here, these first two loops where I do II incremented by 2, and I set based on that, this is just a funny way of implementing for I equals 0, I less than n, I plus plus. And the inner two loops over J are just a funny way of implementing a similar loop over J. And so the actual non-loop indexing related work here for version A is exactly the same in exactly the same order as the original code. We haven't actually changed how the arrays are accessed, and assuming everything else is kept in registers, this means we'll have the exact same data cache accesses. It's not going to be any better. Questions on version A? So in version B, we've done the extra step of reordering the loops. So now the order in which I and J are set is going to be, we have I equals 0, J equals 0, then I equals 1, J equals 1. So far the same as the original code, but then we do I equals 1, J equals 0, I equals 1, J equals 1, I equals 1, J equals 2, and so on. And this means that if we look at C here, I now have more spatial locality in C. Because where previously I was keeping the I the same and advancing the J, now at least I'm doing pairs of I's, so I get some spatial locality in C where I didn't have any before, so this should perform a bunch better. And also, I've hurt my locality in A a bit, and B, but not by very much. So this should overall perform better. And this was my intended answer, but obviously, you know, you kind of need this to not be setting to 0. So questions on version B? Okay. So version C was an unrolled version of the original. This just changed the loop indexing. We're still doing 0, I equals 0, J equals 0, I equals 0, J equals 1, I equals 0, J equals 2. Same order of actual operations as the original, but not something which really helped, you know, got something which helped cache performance. Yes, this might be faster for other reasons, but not for cache performance. And version D, with the correction that this was meant to be A of I plus 1 here, this was an unrolled version of swapping J and I. And that hurts our temporal locality in A substantially. So it's probably a bunch worse. It hurts the temporal locality in A and kind of like makes B and C. Hurts the temporal locality in A, so it should be worse overall. So questions on question one. I should remove the spatial locality remark. So spatial locality in BC, you know, is approx the same over. Approx about the same. I'll skip over question two unless you have questions about it, because enough people got it. Talk about question three and question five. So this was about this add here. And the way this add works is we loaded two values into our 9 and our 10, and then we added them together. Then there's some stuff that's done with our 10, or our 9 rather, after this. But the way this add works is that each loop iteration, we load a new R9 and a new R10. So we don't actually need to know the value of R9 we computed in the previous loop iteration to do the next loop iteration's version of R9. Yes, there might be dependencies on the values we're loading, but not from the add itself. So the adds can actually be done independently for the loop iterations. And so they could be done in parallel. Also, this meant that R9 wasn't something where we were accumulating a value across loop iterations, so it doesn't make sense to do the multiple accumulators transformation tools, right? It's not actually an add where we're adding values across different iterations of the loop, which is the whole point of the multiple accumulators transformations. We can't apply it. Or another way of thinking of it is multiple accumulators try to let us do more adds in parallel. We can already do all the adds into R9 in parallel, provided that the values are loaded in time. Yes? Question, wouldn't the dependencies of the moves make the adds happen in separate cycles? So the loads can actually be done in parallel too on a processor that has enough capacity in its data cache. So that shouldn't be a constraint. So where we might run into dependency issues is that we have to worry about storing to the same place we're loading from. And typically, processors that are trying to be high performance will deal with that by doing something like comparing addresses. So provided that we can determine that, oh, the addresses we're storing to aren't the same as the addresses we're loading to fast enough, that we should be able to do all the loads in parallel and it shouldn't be a problem. Does that answer your question? Question, wouldn't the implementing of RCX need to happen in different cycles? Yes.
Right.
So that is a case where, so the RCX is a case where we would benefit from doing something like loop unrolling to simplify that incrementing.
Wouldn't that make the loads happen in different cycles as well?
The question is, wouldn't that make the loads happen in different cycles? So assuming the loads like took a constant amount of time, yes. But because they're loads from a data cache, they are going to take variable amounts of time. So we're going to end up with a scenario, most likely, where they're finishing at various different times. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, and then there was question four, which is about how do we unroll this. I guess the key thing to realize is that this was our inner loop here, going from the top of the loop to the jump that goes back to the beginning. And our loop unrolling would do, you know, what idea would ideally would only do that comparison, you know, once per iteration after unrolling. So that's why we ended up duplicating E through I in sort of my canonical solution. Question about quiz question four or other parts of the quiz? Yes. Question, don't I have to wait for both of the moves to finish before I can do the add? Yes. But in our processor, what will happen is we think of our like list of instructions, we'll have the move E from iter one. I should write this more clearly. Like our list of instructions will be like move E I equals one, move F I equals one, add move G I equals two, move E, I equals two, move F, I equals two, right? We'll have versions of the adds and the moves from multiple iterations loaded into our list of instructions to run. And if some of those moves are fast or slow, it will end up being the case that we might run two adds from different iterations at the same time. Does that answer your question? So, yeah.
What I'm struggling to see is I don't see, even with the variable length of loads, how they could load something from RCX plus one faster than you could load something from just RCX in like the previous iteration of the network.
Question is, you don't see how the loads could take very amounts of time? Or loads, how we could load iteration I plus one slow faster than I? Adds can happen at the same time. So, I guess part of how this happens is that generally data caches, while they're having a miss, they can do other loads. So, the way this would probably work is we'd have like a cache block that wasn't in the cache, and all the loads to that cache block would take like, you know, 10, 20, 30 cycles. And while that's happening, we'd have stuff that was already cached for future iterations that would run basically right away. And our data caches on modern processors that make the high performance are going to support having several cache misses while we're doing cache hits. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah, back there.
For quiz question four, why is F duplicated?
Quiz question four, why is F duplicated? If you decided not to duplicate F, that is okay, and we'll take care of that when grading the none of the above options, assuming that's what you need. I would say the naive way of writing this, of unrolling it, would duplicate F, and as we'll talk about later, it might actually be hard for the compiler to figure out that it can avoid duplicating F if the compiler is doing the loop unrolling. You doing the loop unrolling will probably figure that out. Compiler might have trouble. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So that's on the quiz. So some logistical notes and assignments. So rotate and smooth checkpoint were originally due next Wednesday. So rotate is a small assignment. Smooth is a bigger assignment. That's why smooth is divided into two parts, the first of which is due with rotate. It's originally due next Wednesday. We're covering some of the stuff you might want to know for rotate and smooth today. I was originally going to extend it to next Friday, but I figured I don't really care, so I'll extend it to just before the break. If you don't want to be working on the week of the break, you are welcome to finish it early, and I would recommend that anyways. These two assignments are both performance homeworks. So the first one, we're going to give you an image, function that takes an image and rotates it. And the second one, We have a function which takes an image and blurs it by taking the average of 3x3 groups of pixels. And we have code that we've given you that implements this already. Your job is to write a faster version that computes the exact same thing. The image is represented as a bunch of pixels which have single byte red, green, and blue, and alpha components, the struct, and it's represented as a row major stored array. So to access x equals 5, y equals 4 in that array, we'll do 4 times the size of the array plus 5. And we're using sort of a 1D flat array because in C and C++, passing a two-dimensional array is not very convenient. And also, this probably makes cache optimization a little clearer. So for rotate, this is the code that we give you. I'm going to talk about what RITX is in a little more detail, but the summary is that RITX IJN is the same thing as I times N plus 2. So this is doing the rotation operation, and your job for the assignment is to come up with some code that does the same thing, but is faster. For rotate, we're not going to tell you what you should do. You need to figure out what sort of thing you can do that probably is something we've learned about to make this faster enough. And the grading for both assignments is that we have some performance threshold on my machine. And if you're that much faster on my machine, you get full credit. And you get full credit regardless of whether you followed our advice or not. For testing on my machine, if you submit to the submission site, we'll run it on my machine with some delay. We have probably less than an hour, but lots of people are submitting, might be a little slower. And there will be a place you can view your results. You can submit multiple potential versions in your submission, and we'll run all of them and show you all the results. So you can try a bunch of things with one submission. Whatever. Generally, things that perform better on your machine are likely to perform better on my machine, maybe not by the same amount. So you should be able to test locally, but the actual results are based on a single reference machine to make things consistent. I say generally they're the same. The one case where you might run into trouble is if you're using a very different compiler than we are, that could cause bigger differences. Okay. So let's talk about this code a little bit. So talk about what this RIDX in this applied code written by our textbook authors is. And this is a preprocessor macro. So it looks like a function, but it's not actually a function. It's a preprocessor macro made with poundify. So here's an example of how that might look. So here I have poundifying double of x times 2. And when I write, after I have that poundifying, if I write double of 100, that turns into 100 times 2. And by turns into, I mean it really turns into that in the sense that this is what the compiler actually compiles. There is no double function. There is no ever in assembly. If you look at the assembly, there will never, ever be a double function. And this is actually just a text substitution. And it really is a text substitution, including in ways which are pretty bad. So for example, if I have that same double and I pass 3 plus 3 to it, well, it replaces the 3 plus 3, replaces the x, so we end up with 3 plus 3 times 2, which is going to be 9, not 12, like you'd expect. Because it is text substitution. It's actually just putting, find and replace x with 3 plus 3. That's what it does. So this is pretty annoying that this happens, that you don't want this to happen. And for this reason, when you see C code that uses macros like this, often you'll see what looks like extra parentheses. Like this, where I have extra parentheses around the x. But they aren't really extra parentheses. They're actually very necessary, because then when we do the text substitution, now we have the precedence we expect. So passing 3 plus 3 the double gives us 12 and not 9. And Linux is a preprocessor macro written with that way, with those extra parentheses, because it's a text substitution. It's not a function call. Questions? And as I mentioned, so the grading is speed up on iMachine. You can submit multiple variants. So for rotate, we're not going to tell you what to do. For smooth, there's very specific advice in the assignment that I strongly recommend following, but the grading is still based on performance. So if you follow that advice, but unlike other people following that advice, don't get much performance benefit, well, you need to figure out why. We're not going to give you credit based on, you know, having followed that advice. We're going to say, did you manage to make it fast? And if you manage to get the performance that we require without following our advice for smooth, that's fine too. So, questions on the performance assignment? So rotate and smooth. Okay, so let's talk a bit about what compilers do. So that's going to be a big topic today, is compilers doing or not doing optimizations. So if I take our writing example of this loop that does a sum, in this case I'm doing a sum of longs, the unoptimized version of that loop code, if I just compile it without telling GCC, don't do any optimizations, just compile it, it ends up with actually really horrible assembly code. This assembly code is, you know, is storing A, the pointer to the array, on the stack, so it retrieves A from the stack, adds the offset based on I to it, then loads that, and then it adds that to result in this case, which is stored on the stack. So this is not how you'd write assembly, probably, and it's obviously pretty hideously inefficient. But fortunately, I can tell the same compiler, please do some optimization. And I can do that by passing some useful command line flag. So in this case, I pass capital OS, which for GCC means optimize for size. This is often what I do when I'm showing assembly on slides, because I like the assembly being short. But it's optimized for size, not speed. So in this case, it produces nice short assembly that will happen to be faster and is a lot more straightforward. I can also tell it to optimize for speed. So the same version of GCC, I set optimization level 2, which is trying to optimize for speed. And this is the code I got. So it simplified the array indexing in a loop, so that's often going to be faster. Often doing this array indexing is a bit, takes a, more operations, more an extra ALU operation, so it'd be slower. And also it made the loop have just a conditional jump at the end, rather than this short version, which had, was less code overall, but now it has an extra jump in the loop to just save some space. So that's our version. And, well, this is actually, I can do more with a compiler. So this is an old version of GCC. If you know GCC development, GCC is up to like version 11 right now. And also, optimization level 2 isn't the most aggressive I can ask for. So tried the same thing on GCC version 9 and asked for optimization level 3. Please try really hard to do lots of stuff that might make this code faster. And it generates code where the actual loop part of the code uses this move GQU instruction, which happens to load 16 bytes at a time. That's two longs worth of stuff rather than one, and uses this PAD instruction, which happens to add two pairs of longs. So it's one instruction that does two adds. We'll talk more about those instructions next week. And it just did this for us. So it's actually using multiple accumulators and writing instructions you probably didn't know about. And if I also tell the compiler, hey, don't just optimize at level 3, optimize for my processor, which is the Intel Skylake architecture, it uses an instruction that instead adds 4 pairs of logs, happens to exist. So now we're doing 4 times as much work per loop. And you might say, okay, well, you know, this is something I didn't know how to do, but we still learned about like loop unrolling, right? And you know, we still need to do loop unrolling to make this better. And well, turns out I can tell the compiler, please unroll the loop too. You just pass in an option, say, I'd like you to unroll the loop. And it will just do it. There we go. It rolls the loop and is still using those instructions that do lots of adds in one instruction. Or I can try some other compiler. So for example, if I use Clang version 9 and tell it to optimize for my processor, it generates a unrolled loop that uses multiple accumulators and these instructions that do a bunch of adds at once. And you might say, looking at this, gosh, you know, if I just tell our compilers to do optimizations, why are we bothering learning about loop unrolling and multiple accumulators? Can't I just pass these flags to my compilers and have all this work done for me? And the answer is, sometimes yes. So the compilers will do this. One thing to realize is that often these optimizations aren't the default. And the compilers are good at different things than humans are for optimization. So there's some optimizations compilers are really good at, and there's some that they're not so good at. And we're going to talk about sort of 4 different issues that compilers have and look at some specific problems and optimizations related to them, you know, where compilers might not do optimizations you expect. So one limitation, going to be the first one we talk a lot about, a specific example of this, is that when compilers optimize code, the new code needs to do the same thing. You might say, well, of course. But the problem is the compiler needs to do this in every case, even though you as a human looking at a code would say, well, no one's going to call this function that way. The compiler can't say that. The compiler can't say, no one's going to use this function with that weird number. The compiler needs to assume the worst and needs to make the code work in weird corner cases that we looking at code know don't actually matter. But that's not how what the compiler's being asked to do. It's being asked to actually do the exact thing the code specifies, not sort of what's intended. Also, compilers, for the most part, with some exceptions, kind of work a function at a time, or if not a function at a time, a file at a time. So working a file at a time is kind of a restriction of, well, you know, we have to produce an object file, we can't look at the other C files until we're making the executable. So for the most part, with some exceptions, compilers are going to work a file at a time, and within that, typically they'll work a function at a time because of performance issues. Like, if the compiler's like trying to look over all our code across function calls, that's going to be a lot of extra work. It's going to make your compile time slow. So even though compilers have support for this, usually they won't do it very much because, you know, you don't want compiling a single like C++ file to take 2 minutes. Another thing is that compilers, when they're looking at your code, they don't know what your numbers are going to be. They don't know if that loop you have there typically runs with n=4 or n=1,000. So the compiler is going to generally make choices that are okay for, you know, most cases and not, that might not, you know, take into account like whether something is or is not important based on what the values typically are. And related to that, a lot of the optimizations we've talked about make code bigger. So if we look at what Clang generated here, this is a lot of code. And in fact, I didn't show the setup code, which is another 35 lines, including handling like leftover from loop unrolling and all that. And also, I didn't show the code after the loop. So a lot of optimizations you might want the compiler to do make the code a lot bigger. And the compiler is kind of just making guesses as to when that's a good trade-off for you. And that's why the compiler's not going to do this by default, might not do it even with some options, because it just has to guess, is it worth actually making this code a lot bigger to potentially make it faster? Because if we keep doing that, well, not only are we going to have a very big executable, which you probably would not be happy if like your executables were like an extra couple megabytes every time, but also we'll have potentially things running slower in some cases because we'll run out of space in like our instruction cache. So let's first talk about maybe the most sort of pernicious and annoying issue that compilers run into, which is this issue that they need to make code do the exact same thing even in corner cases. There's one type of corner cases called aliasing. And here's a function where we'll run into aliasing. So so this function takes in a pointer to a long x and a long y. And the idea is it does x plus equals y twice. And we might say, well, what this should do is this should be the same as px plus equals py times 2. Sorry, py times 2, right? We should just be able to load the y ones, multiply it by 2 by adding it to itself most likely, or shifting it, and then add that to x. Like, that's how we'd like to implement this. We don't want to actually store a value into x twice, like the code like literally says to do. Here's some code which does that, and as it says on the slide, the compiler can't do that. That is not a legal compilation of this function. And it's not legal because there's a corner case where that compilation gives the wrong answer. Someone tell me what that case is. Yeah.
Is it overflow?
Overflow is fine. In this case, the overflow should give us the same answer. But there's a... Tell me what the case is. So something about the arguments to the function. Where it's not legal translation. Okay. So let's go over what the name of this thing that's on the slide is. Aliasing. So aliasing means having two different names for the same thing. So this is what our problem is going to be. So if we think of this example here, how can we have two different names for the same thing? Well, we can think of star px is a name for one thing, and star py is a name for another thing. And let's say we have them are names for the same thing. Could that happen? Absolutely. Because I could say pass two pointers to a z as my x and y. In that case, what the code is supposed to do ends up being equivalent to if I did z plus equals z twice. And that's going to multiply z times 4. And my proposed implementation that's supposed to be faster, well, what that's going to do in that case is that's going to end up being z plus equals z times 2, which is going to give us z times 3. So we get a different value for z if I call, two pointers to z to this function. So that's a corner case where this function, this compilation of this function is wrong. It will give us the wrong value. And the compiler can't do that, therefore. Can't compile the function this way because it gives the wrong answer. And this means that the compiler has basically two choices. So one option is it can generate the version of the function that writes to px twice and reads from py twice because it's going to write and then read back and say, see, maybe it's going to read back the same thing it just wrote. Or the compiler can add like a comparison to check whether px and py are the same thing and have like two different versions of the code for that. Both cases, not very nice. So the compiler really can't implement this optimization. And we as humans are going to look at this code and say, why would you ever call this function with two copies of the same pointer? Like, it doesn't make any sense, is probably what we'd say. And in a more realistic scenario, we'd like have documentation for this function. And the documentation would tell us something like, you know, adds 2 times py to px, or something like that. Something that would tell us, you know, what we expect the function to do or not do in that case, and often would say, if you pass the same pointer twice, doesn't make any sense. And we know you shouldn't need to care about the case. But the compiler, all it has is the code, has to make the code do the exact same thing that it would do if we executed a statement at a time. It can't implement this optimization because of this aliasing issue, because px, star px, and star py might be the same. So questions about this example of aliasing and it preventing this nice optimization we wanted? So you probably say, this is very contrived. Does this happen in like real programs? And the answer is, unfortunately, all the time. Let me give you a less contrived example. So here, I have a function which takes a matrix, and I'm going to sum up the rows into an array of sums. And ideally, what we'd like to happen is we'd like, when this is compiled, we'd like this thing, you know, this should be kept in a register. And because of aliasing, the compiler probably can't do that. And remember, aliasing, if you need to have two names for the same thing, how could we have two names for the same thing? Well, the answer is I could call this function with something like two pointers to different parts of the same array. So in this case, I'm storing my results in the middle of my matrix, and the way this has to way that telling the compiler to do this is that the compiler might read back one of the results I wrote while it's computing the sum. And it needs to worry about that happening to implement the code as I have written it. We, reading this code and knowing what sum rows means, say, no one should ever call the function like this. Like, that doesn't make any sense. But the compiler, it needs to implement exactly what that's supposed to do, you know, according to the C specification. And that says that, you know, we're going to write to result that's going to change the matrix, and we should, after we write to it, we should read it back from the matrix, even in the same for loop. And this means that the compiler probably is going to compile the top version differently than this bottom version here, where I've made a variable sum, or actually needs to compile it differently than this bottom version, where I've made a variable sum, which probably can be kept in a register, probably will be kept in a register. And this also tells you, what can you do about this aliasing problem? You, by making a variable like this, that clearly doesn't depend on, you know, anything, any pointers, are going to tell the compiler, oh, this is something to keep in a register. Something you can definitely keep in a register. You don't need to worry about, like, storing something here and reading it back later. Because it's a local variable, there's no pointers to it, that's not possible. So questions about this aliasing example? Yeah?
I guess this is not like a big question, but I just wonder like, how does the compiler know that, how exactly does it execute to detect such edge cases?
Question, how does the compiler detect such edge cases? So I think probably a better way of thinking about it is that the compiler is going to look at this code and say, can I keep this in a register? And as a prerequisite for doing that, it needs to prove that nothing, that this code, the rest of the code doesn't read from that thing we wrote. And if it can't prove that, it's going to give up on keeping it in a register. Does that answer your question? Question, is this something that the compiler does on its own? So, no. The compiler can't compile these the same way, because in this corner case here, they must give different answers, right? That's how C works. So the compiler can't do this fix on its own. It can do something similar. So what the compiler could do is it could generate code something like this, where it checks whether there's whether result and the matrix overlap, and has like sort of a backup case. But otherwise, if the compiler is not doing something like this, you need to, you know, give the compiler the information it needs, and this is one way of doing. The second version is a way of doing that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So, because of this aliasing issue, there's in fact a difference in performance. So if I compile with a low optimization level, here are these lines are, as the size increases, what the cycles per count is, and you can see that the version in blue, which is with the aliasing problem, is a bit slower than the version in green without the aliasing problem because of the extra data cache accesses. Yes, they're always cache hits, but we have extra loads and stores that's gonna take some time. And a bigger issue is that because of this aliasing, the compiler would have trouble doing other optimizations that it might be able to do. So with the optimization level 3, there's a huge difference in performance. And what happened basically is that with the version without aliasing, the compiler realized, oh, this is a value in a register, I can do multiple accumulators for that. With the version with the aliasing problem, the compiler said, well, I can't really do multiple accumulators because I actually need to care about keeping the same variable, like because I might read it back. So we have this huge difference in performance. So this is often a thing which happens in aliasing, is that the aliasing problem not only prevents sort of the obvious, like simple, like keep something in a register optimization, it also prevents other optimizations kind of downstream of that, where we like transform loops, because the compiler just, you know, needs to be really careful about doing any manipulation to the loop because of that concern about, I'm going to read back the value I just wrote. So as I said, the compiler hypothetically could do this itself, and probably some compilers sometimes do this. But this gets, you know, this, first of all, it's an extra check that's going to take some time that we don't really need. And secondly, you know, this is duplicating the code, right? So the compiler's probably not going to do this most of the time. It's probably just going to write the safe version and say, hopefully that's fast enough. Questions about okay. So aliasing is something which has a lot of interaction with cache optimizations. So here's some code that does a cache block matrix multiply with 2x2 blocks where I've expanded the innermost loops. And something we'd like to happen here is we'd like the compiler to only load this value from A once for the two uses of it in multiplies. Like, that would be a nice thing for the compiler to do. But the compiler probably is not able to do that because the compiler needs to worry that that element of A could in fact be the same thing as this element of C that we store here, or the one we store here. Right, it needs to worry that these could be the same parts of the same array, and it happens that sometimes the I and J's work out, but they map to the exact same index. That's something the compiler needs to worry about in this code, and that means the compiler, even though it's obvious to us that you can just load A of I times N plus K once, the compiler can't do that because it needs to reload it after it stores to C or otherwise make sure that those writes to C are not going to change the value. Some questions? Question, is there a way to set a flag so the compiler doesn't worry about aliasing? So Basically, no. So I guess there's two practical solutions here. The one we talk about is this, that you can make your own variables to, you can like tell the compiler, this aliasing isn't happening by just making a local variable, to suggest very strongly the compiler should keep things in a register, because that's the most natural way of compiling this. So I guess I don't have slides on it, I think. There is technically, in the C standard, there is a way to mark pointers as this pointer does not alias other pointers. I don't have slides on it because in my experience, most compilers don't do much with it, even though theoretically it's supposed to solve the, be a way of telling the compiler there's no aliasing here. As far as like just to like a command line flag to like say there's no aliasing, the problem with that is that there are lots of real cases where the compiler should still worry about aliasing, right? It would be pretty bad if the compiler assumed all your pointers to ints never pointed to a particular global variable, right? Because the optimizations that are possible that probably break all pointers, like if that's the way we're going. So we need to have some sort of limitations, and it's not easy to set that. And the C standard's idea of this way of marking specific pointers as not aliasing other pointers is probably the best idea for doing that I've seen. But it's not easy to come up with a way that's practical that isn't going to break a lot of real code, you know, where the aliasing is kind of obvious to humans and is intended. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So a way of avoiding this is that we can make local variables, which the compiler probably needs to implement with either registers or values on the stack. That should make the compiler actually only load things once. And this is generally a pattern we use to, you know, avoid aliasing problems. Okay, so let's talk a little about aliasing examples now that we know what it is. So here I have a function that adds S1 and S2, two different arrays, into D, our destination array, 1,000 elements, and here's my hypothetical version that the compiler can't generate, where you know I load the two values from S1 and S2, add them together, and then store the two values in the destination. So these are not equivalent. What are examples where we'd have different answers? A little bit of time. Who would like some more time? Three people, okay. Okay, so who thinks A would be different, could have different results. The same, A would not have different results. Okay. B would have different results. B would have not have different results. C would have different results. C would not have different results. Okay. D would have different results. D would not have different results. Okay, so we seem to have pretty good certainty that there, where is my, interest. Okay, that there's a problem with, well, first of all, there's no problem with A, so I'd say not A, and the reason why is we're writing to a different actual array than we're reading from, so that's going to be fine. With B, there is a problem, and illustrating this way, if we think of the first two iterations of the first loop, we're doing A of 1 equals A of 0 plus A of 0, and then we're reading back that value we just wrote right away. Whereas in the second loop, I compute A of 1 plus A of 1 without reading back a value I modify. So we'll have different answers for A of 1, for A of 2, I should say, for both cases, and so we'll get a different value. And this is because if we look at this call, you know, we're reading from A of 0 to write A of 1, reading from A of 1 to write A of 2, and so on. So C, I think, is probably the trickiest one. So C, we do have overlap, but there's no problem because we only go ahead in A by two elements at a time, and we're 10 elements ahead, so we're always going to read stuff that we haven't overwritten yet, even with the changed order. It would be a problem if instead of having this be 2, it was like 100, but this is, you know, as long as plus equals 2, this is fine. If it's like, if we extended this transformation to be like plus equals 8, plus equals 16, then we'd have a problem. And D is no problem because we're reading from A starting at 1,000, but we only write to the first 1,000 elements of A, so there's no overlap. I should write, be consistent here. Some questions on these cases. Okay. Aliasing. I guess another note about aliasing with cache optimization. So I showed you about sort of that aliasing prevents us from like loading things into registers. It also prevents the compiler from doing things like cache blocking most of the time, or even like changing loop orders, which we talked about before we introduced cache blocking. And the issue here is that, let's say C and A are parts of the same array. In that case, we really can't like swap, you know, in this case, K and J loops or anything like that, even though we know that the way this code is supposed to be used, that won't change anything, because A, B, and C could be pointers to different parts of the same array, that's probably not something the compiler could do. Or at least it can't do it without some extra code to like handle, you know, what if there is overlap, which maybe that some compilers will do that, but that's a bunch of extra work. It can't just do the cache optimizations that you would write without adding those extra checks because of aliasing. And the overlap is a problem because, you know, in this case, we have to worry, you know, if I'm writing to C, am I going to read that back later and, you know, read it back at different times with these two versions? Some questions about aliasing and cache optimizations in general? So this explains why the compiler doesn't do cache blocking for you. does. It's not that it's not possible to do, it's that the compiler usually doesn't have enough information to do it without adding lots of extra checks. Yeah. What question? Why did I say that A and B are distinct large arrays? So I wanted to avoid the question of do we go out of bounds? That's the large part. And the distinct part is that, like, I wanted to avoid the issue of what if, you know, int star B is in fact like A of 1 or something like that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So, talked about aliasing. Now, let's talk about some specific cases of optimizations that we know compilers can do, but generally don't. So, cache blocking, we mentioned. Aliasing is probably a big reason why compilers just won't just do that for you. When we saw loop unrolling, well, that's something that actually doesn't run into these problems very much. But compilers won't just do loop unrolling all the time by default, generally. And why not? Well, one issue is that if they do it all the time, we'll have bigger executables, and ultimately that can hurt performance because we'll have more instruction cache misses. And in particular, loop unrolling is probably going to be slower for loops that only run a few times. Like, if we have a loop that typically runs 3 times, and we unroll it 10 times, well, we've just added a bunch of extra comparisons and made our executable a lot bigger for performance decrease. So if loop unrolling is really useful, but we want to somehow identify the loops that are important to actually unroll and not just unroll everything, because that will just make our program probably slower and definitely bigger, taking up more space in our instruction cache, more space on disk. And the compiler often doesn't really have information that lets it guess what loops are useful to enroll and what loops aren't. And if we think about sort of, you know, looking at code like this might be the type of information the compiler has because it's like going a function at a time. So it's like, it has to say, is some variable usually like 3? In which case you probably shouldn't unroll this. Or is it usually like 10,000? In which case, maybe that's very, very worth doing. Is some function something that takes like 2 minutes? In which case, unrolling it's not going to really do much, right? Because if it takes 2 minutes, like who cares about the extra couple nanoseconds to do the comparisons? Or is it something that like takes like 10 nanoseconds? In which case, it might be really worth unrolling. Like the compiler often won't have that information, and so it won't be able to make good choices about what to unroll, so it's just going to make some guesses or be very conservative to avoid unrolling all the time and just making our program slow. Also, there's some cases where the compiler might have trouble doing loop unrolling for other reasons. So in this case, why can the compiler not do this loop unrolling I showed here? Like, why is that not a legal transformation? Tell me what the problem is. So this is a problem kind of similar to aliasing, but not the same problem. The same kind of problem. So what's the corner case in which the transform foo doesn't do the same thing as foo? And it's going to have something to do with what some function is. So what can I put in some function to make them not equivalent? No one came up with it. So here's an example of a some function that will not be equivalent. My some function just sets some global variable equals a random number. Now they're very much not equivalent, right? Because we decided the number of iterations. So the transform one assumes global variable doesn't change, but it absolutely could. So this is another a case where something else, compiler details the compiler needs to deal with. So we, looking at this code, know you'd be stupid to make some function change the global variable. The compiler needs to say, well, that's legal, have to let you do that, and therefore can't generate this code without generating like some if I plus one is less than some global variable extra check, just in case you changed it. Some questions about this case with loop unrolling? Okay. And I would say these problems that apply to loop unrolling also apply to doing multiple accumulators on top of it. Yes, it's something compilers can do. You know, they can look for that pattern and do it, but it has all the same issues that it makes the code bigger, and it's not actually helpful if we have a small number of loop iterations. The compiler often has trouble figuring out that it's worth doing. So in our last few minutes, we'll talk about one other optimization that compilers are pretty good at, but you know, don't always do when you want them to do it, because they have to make guesses. And this is dealing with this loop with a function call here. So here I have a function, and we think of this function, if we think of the assembly for it, it's like an add, a compare, and a conditional move, probably. Like it's like three instructions of actual work. So that this add with limit function. So it's an add, it's a compare, it's probably a conditional move to send 10,000 to the return value instead of another thing. But if we think of the loop using this function, it's going to have to run an instruction to move the array element into an register, to move the sum into a register. It's going to have to make a function call. There's going to have to be a return. So we're running four extra instructions for this three instruction function. So that's awfully inconvenient. That's like a lot of extra work we're doing just to call this function. And what would be better is to do what's called inlining the call. So rather than calling the function, we'll copy the body of the function in there, changing the registers to directly use, you know, EAX, the sum variable, you know, and so on. And by doing this, we should avoid those four instructions. And this should be a bunch faster. Also, this is going to help us because it's going to like free up extra registers we can use in our loop because we don't have to worry about like saving caller safe registers and so on. So questions about this inlining idea? Okay. So this is something that you could absolutely do by hand. And it's also something that's actually very easy for the compiler to do. Like it's a very mechanical transformation. There's no aliasing issues really. But it doesn't always help, right? We have, you know, if we do this all the time, we're having lots of extra copies of the function, right? And that's just gonna make extra code. It's gonna make our instruction cache much bigger. If the function's actually used a bunch, we won't get the benefits of the temporal locality from the function being used as much, because if it's used from two different places, we now have two different copies from inlining. So it's not actually something we want to do all the time. So compilers will do inlining, but there's sort of two big restrictions about when they'll do it. So one is that they're going to try to guess, is it worth inlining this function? And typically the way they make that guess is they say, you know, is the function small enough? And that's a pretty good idea, but they're looking at, is the function small enough, you know, based on the size of the code of the function? They're probably not looking at, oh, you know, am I going to be able to simplify this function when I do other optimizations? They probably won't take that into account. They'll just have some quick check, you know, is this a small function? If so, inline it, otherwise don't. They're not going to figure out, oh, after I inline it, I can simplify the loop a bunch or something like that. They're not going to look inside the function to do that decision, because they're, you know, basically working a function at a time. Another thing is that compilers can't inline between different object files. If I have one C file with my function and another C file that calls it, when I'm compiling the C file that calls it, the compiler generally won't know about the body of the other function, so it can't inline it. Now, some compilers have ways of doing optimizations when you make the executable, which get around this issue, but that's generally not the default. And when you do enable it, it's going to be a bunch slower, right? Because now we are losing the advantage of compiling each file separately, you know, and not needing to recompile things all the time. So compilers absolutely can do inlining. They're very good at it as far as like doing the mechanical transformation of inlining, but they won't always do it when you want. They're making guesses, and they also have limitations on, they need to have the function to inline. You know, they have to have body of the function to put there. And also they're making guesses about when it's appropriate, or guesses might be wrong. Okay, so questions on inlining. Okay, and sort of as our last topic, we're going to talk about one other type of optimization that comes up a little in this move assignment that's more straightforward. So here, I have a function here, and this function has a problem that's a big O problem. This function is quadratic. Someone tell me why this is quadratic. As I've written it, it's quadratic. What's the problem? Yeah. Question, are we computing length of the string each time? Absolutely. So we're calling string len each iteration of the loop. The way string len works, it looks for an old terminator. So that takes order n time. So this ends up being quadratic. And you might say, well, can the compiler fix this for us? And the answer is probably not. Because the compiler, it needs to know how string len works in order to know that it's not going to give a different number each time. It also, you know, because, you know, and even if it knows how string len works, it needs to know that the code in the loop doesn't change the string. So the compiler probably won't do this for us, but we can do it. That's useful, and you should keep in mind, you know, since the compiler generally looks a function at a time, it's not going to be able to figure out things like, oh, this function call gets the same answer each time. You're going to have to do that yourself. So here's another example where we can avoid doing an operation as much. So here, I'm doing lots of comparisons of I to I plus amount and I to n, and I can remove some comparisons. I guess for time reasons, I'll go over. So here it seems like, you know, we kind of have to do that. But an observation I can make here is that once I plus amount is greater than or equal to n, it stays that way, then I plus 1 amount is plus 1 plus amount is also greater than or equal to n, right? Once that comparison's true, it stays true indefinitely. And so I can think of this as what I'm doing is I have I from 0 to n minus amount, I'm doing this code here, and for the rest of the loop, I'm doing that case, right? We can kind of split up the i's into the first if case and the second if case, and they can be separate loops. And by doing that, rather than doing two comparisons every iteration, I'm doing one. And so I end up with code like this. And this is actually more helpful than it seems. I'm not just removing a comparison, I also end up with nice, simple loops. And this loop, this is, you know, easier to do other optimizations on. Like it's much, like loop unrolling that's a lot nicer than loop unrolling the other one, and there's other optimizations we'll learn about next time that are a lot easier after I do this transformation. So that's where I'll leave off this now. Next week we're gonna talk about those instructions that did multiple adds at a time. We'll talk about what are those instructions, how do they work, how can we use them, when do compilers use them or not use them. And that's also going to be the second part of the smooth assignment after the checkpoint that we'll be.